WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
Sex. The topic can make people uncomfortable and squeamish, and it's still taboo to talk about it frankly. But this can lead to a lot of misinformation and myths that affect health, particularly women's health. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. As Women's History Month winds down, we want to focus on women's sexual health and the ways that a knowledge gap seems to persist across generations. So I sat down with a panel of women, including a gynecologist, to discuss stigma, debunk some myths, and share best practices from Gen Z to Gen X. Taisha Thomas is a Gen Zer and a student at DePaul University. Dr. Tracy Kurtzer is a gynecologist and menopause specialist with the Northwestern Medicine Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause. Cheryl Jackson, who you might know from WBEZ's podcast, When Magic Happens, well, she's the CEO of My Own Doctor and a proud member of Gen X. Oh, and me, I'm the millennial in the bunch. We started by discussing our experiences with sex education in school. Here's Dr. Kurtzer.
I almost can't even remember it. That's how impactful it was. I do think there was a combined group of us, so it was they did not separate us into boys and girls, as I recall, and it was pretty limited. For us girls, it was really focused around maybe the onset of menstruation, mm-hmm. not much about infections or pregnancy prevention. It was pretty much kind of all about like that reproduction, menstruation piece.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, doctor, because I can only remember us learning about the reproduction piece of things. I remember the day that our teacher brought a banana in and showed us how to put a condom on. And, you know, it was very male focused and nothing on, like you said, infection or barely any talk of how to prevent yourself, you know, from getting STDs. What about you, Cheryl? Do you remember what sex ed was like in school?
Yes, it was very lacking. I was raised in the Bible Belt. So I was raised in Memphis in the 70s, going to school in the 70s and early 80s. All I can recall is a diagram explaining, you know, the gestation period of a baby. That is it. There was no discussion about, it was bold actually, bringing out a banana and putting on a condom. That never happened in my school.
This was in Canada, so I don't know if that makes a difference.
Okay, all right.
Well, Taisha, bring it home for us. I mean, how was it for you? I'm curious if things have evolved.
So I actually grew up in Texas. We had an abstinence-based sexual ed. I don't even want to call it a class because it was a single day. It was more like a seminar where they separated the boys and the girls. Mm-hmm. And we got to talking about our menstruation and to not have sex. And that's pretty much what we got. I did end up taking a human sexuality class at DePaul last quarter with Susan Marcinos. That was really comprehensive. And I loved that class. But as far as sex ed that I got in school in my primary days, it was not great.
And part of the intention of this conversation, too, is to look at that, right? Whether there has been some sort of evolution between sort of how some of us were taught back in the day versus how they're teaching, you know, in more recent days, and whether any of that contributes to some of the gaps that we've seen when it comes to women's health over men's. Doctor, on the Chicago Public Schools website, there's a blurb about providing, quote, age-appropriate, medically accurate and comprehensive sexual health education to students in grades pre-K to 12, end quote, right? Now, this includes creating classroom rules, learning about personal space in preschool and kindergarten, In fourth grade, they learn about gender identity, sexual orientation, and puberty. In eighth grade, they're supposed to learn about communication about their bodies, identifying appropriate and inappropriate behavior, STIs, also talking with a medical professional about sexual health. What do you make of their current sex ed plan at CPS?
I was pretty happy when I read that legislation and then hearing that it had gotten passed and signed into law by Governor Pritzker, because I think it really set some standards and it expanded also the narrow focus that I think typically sex ed has always been.
Yeah.
You know, heteronormative kind of relationships and really making sure that there's awareness and acceptance, because it's a difficult time for kids if they feel like they're different from their peers. So
yeah,
it's truly important. And then I think the other focus that I found so important is somebody who actually had taught a little sex ed back in the day when I was doing some general OB-GYN in our local public school, is there was nothing to cover on healthy relationships. And I think that is entirely lacking, particularly for young girls, but boys to learn too, that yeah, there are boundaries and our bodies are in our own charge and control. And if we don't start teaching that when we're younger for mm-hmm. young people, that's where, you know, problems can come up later.
Cheryl, you talked about the lack of sex ed back in the day and in the Bible Belt. Now, when you were at the stage of life when you started having menstrual cycles and you started being sexually active or maybe using contraception even, do you feel like you were prepared with the information you needed at the time?
Not at all. Not at all. There was, unfortunately, no discussion with anyone when I started my menstrual cycle.
Not even family?
Not even family.
So how'd you navigate that?
As best as I could. It was a very weird time. Well, you know how kids do. Mm-hmm. You know, you swap and exchange information amongst yourselves.
Right.
So I think it's probably, you know, unfortunately, probably another little girl, 12 years old, you know, sharing her experiences with her cycle. I didn't get my cycle until much later. Mm-hmm. I was very much late bloomer. So I had the benefit of other girls and their experiences.
Yeah.
But I never had the conversation, a formal yeah. conversation or informal conversation with any, you know, inside my family or out, you know, yeah. other kind of formal authority figures, which is why mm-hmm. when I saw those books at a store, you know, it was a girl's store. I picked them up and I bought them. And I was like, my nieces will not have the experience that I had.
Yes, that is so true. I can relate in more ways than one, because fast forward, I have daughters now who are teens, but when they were preteens, I picked up some of those books that you're referring to. I know, I think American Girl has a series.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I did the same.
That's the one.
Because mm-hmm. like you, Cheryl, I mean, I got my cycle when I was 13. I think it was the summer when I was turning 13. And I mean, that was kind of the first conversation with my mom on anything to do with that. I just remember I was going on a summer vacation and she just stuffed my suitcase with menstrual pads and was like, here you go. and we had, you know, sort of a quick conversation on how to do things and what I would need while I was going to be away from her in that period. But there was no other conversation. There was certainly not a conversation that I felt comfortable having about sex. And so fast forward to my mid-20s when I have my first child, that's kind of the first time my family even like sees my boyfriend and you know, gets any sort of hint that I had been having sex all this time. Taisha, what's it like for you? I mean, you're of the younger generation, Gen Z, right? Are people still keeping things from parents? Or
oh, for sure.
Are they?
Yeah, no. As with my mother, she would like to think that she was a very opening and accepting space. When it came to some things, definitely like my sexual orientation, I do identify as a lesbian and mm-hmm. she's super accepting of that. But in terms of actually talking about like sexual experiences, definitely not as much. I actually didn't even know that periods existed before I got mine. So when I did get it, I thought I was dying. I woke up in the middle of the night, I was bleeding, and I went over to her and I was crying, I was freaking out, and she was like, oh, this is so normal. And I'm like, you couldn't tell me this before.
Oh, wow.
I did have one of those American Girl books, though. She didn't directly give it to me. She snuck it onto my bookshelf so that I would find it. Mm-hmm. And that was how we communicated, I guess.
Oh, no.
You know, sometimes that's an effective technique, I found, though. I raised two daughters myself, and sometimes when there have been times where I could tell it was going to be a hard conversation for them to open up to me, not having to have that direct eye contact with them, kind of side to side. And you know, putting a book down and just kind of leaving it somewhere is not a bad technique for parents to just open up and get that information, because we have the American Girl dolls and books, too. Mm-hmm. And it's a great series. It gives some really good basic and then more advanced education.
Yeah. Well, Taisha, are there older adults in your life or your mom even that you talk to about sex now? I mean, you had to have a conversation about your sexual orientation.
Yes. So she acknowledges the fact that I have a partner. We still do not talk about sex, at least not in my family. Mm. When it comes to older adults, I definitely have some aunts that are a little bit more open with things like that. I remember seeing my first sex scene in a movie. It was with my aunt. I think it was Friends with Benefits movies or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And she was like, oh, it's fine. You're old enough to see a body. And then she was like, wait, that was maybe a little much. But even then, people in the family try to be a little bit more respectful to my mother. And I guess feel like it's not their place to do so.
Yeah. Interesting. Cheryl, I mean, you are working in the medical space as well. I mean, do a lot of people close to you talk to you about sex? I'm curious.
I think now, certainly among my girlfriends, I talk about it with my nieces and nephews, cousins. It's funny, the other day I was hosting a webinar on Let's Talk About Sex, women's sexual health and bodies. And I told my mom, you know, who's 86 now. And I said, Mom, I'm having this great conversation tonight, a webinar. We're going to be talking about women's sexual health. I said, you know, Mom, it's so important to normalize talking about this. And then without missing a beat, she's like, that's not normal to have the conversation about it.
Oh, wow.
I said, this is precisely why I'm having this conversation, so that we can talk about something that is so much a part of our bodies. And I had a really rough go at my reproductive health most of my life, particularly reproductive life. And I just, and not to have anyone to talk about it, it was just unfortunate. And I want differently for women.
Yeah. Do you think there's still a stigma around talking about sex, Dr. Kurtzer? You're nodding.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I talk about sex every day with many patients, so the last thing I want to do is talk about my own with other people. But but I do think I still hear that, like, people are coming to consult in the office for sexual dysfunction, and yet they're still averting their eyes. They're still saying, you probably don't want to hear this, or this might be too much information. So there's still a lot of stigma around it.
So older Gen Zers, Taisha, they might be thinking about family planning, whether that's to have kids or not to have kids. I know that you have talked about being child-free,
yes,
as well as the fact that a lot of family planning can be on the woman's plate,
yes,
right? Talk more about that.
Yeah, so even just with contraception alone, I can only think of two specific contraceptions that men will do, and that's basically condoms and vasectomies. That's pretty much it, versus women.
If they want to do a vasectomy, because that's a whole other conversation.
Yes, versus women are more saddled with take a pill every day for pretty much the rest of your life until you want babies, or have IUDs inserted.
Get a patch.
Get a patch. And all of that always falls on the women, I feel. And it's usually a conversation had amongst, if it is a heterosexual couple, of the man who's like, well, get on birth control so we can, you know, have a little bit more fun, or not, so I don't have to use a condom. And I think when it does come to actual child rearing, even that tends to fall on women. So the whole aspect of just planning for a family, to even having a family and maintaining that family, has always historically and culturally fallen onto women. So I don't think men pay as much attention to maybe that. And I have seen some statistics come out lately that said women are more likely to identify as child-free or to just have second thoughts about having a family or like having children versus men. I feel like they can kind of have the fantasy of being like, oh, I'll be a dad, but they don't necessarily have to worry about the workload that comes with that.
That is true. And we've had that very conversation here on Reset just months ago, just about just how many women are just kind of making the decision to not have children at this point in time. For me, you know, as a millennial, as they say, we didn't have formal family planning conversations with our friends. The people around me were just having babies. In high school, having babies. Middle school, even. I can remember four girls that got pregnant in the seventh grade. And it was just a thing. Everybody around me was just having babies. So fast forward when you, you know, reconnect with folks on Facebook in those spaces that you used to go to school with, they've got kids that are way older than mine because they started much earlier than I did. So there weren't formal conversations. It was just a lot of oops. It was just happening. Were we misinformed? Was it just a time where we just were more carefree? I'm not sure. But I'm curious, Cheryl and Dr. Kurtzer, what you all were thinking about in your 20s or what things looked like back then for you. Cheryl, you go first.
Well, I tell you, it was very much instilled in me and women and girls my age that do not get pregnant, period. That seemed to be the worst thing in life to me, was to get pregnant. Like my life would be over, not because of the responsibility that comes with having a child, because of the pressure and societal norms that was very much not normal. And so, you know, one of my cousins was telling me that her dad, he had eight girls, and he just scared the Jesus out of them, like, you better not get pregnant. But there is no conversation around how not to get pregnant other than abstinence. And I think they didn't even mention the word abstinence. It's like it was just assumed.
Yeah.
Don't get pregnant. Don't have sex. So I was preoccupied with that. And I was not sexually active until much later in life. I don't know. It's because of the trauma of the do not get pregnant, which I'm sort of, you know, irritated by. That's another conversation. But that was the predominant. And you know, I just didn't try birth control too much later in life, but it was more or less as a result of not having a conversation about my body in general. I was having very difficult cycles, lots of pain.
Yeah.
Very abnormal pain, throwing up, passing out. But everyone around me said it was just a normal part of being a woman. I got the don't have a baby part. But meanwhile, I was losing my fertility. And no one was helping guide me on that, or no one was saying this is not normal, or even sitting at, you know, my 20s when I, you know, eventually went to a gynecologist. It wasn't, you know, oh, well, you know, tough going. You still got to go to class, you know, still have to go to work. That's what I was told when they saw how much pain I was in. It was, don't think this is going to get you out of school. You have to keep your life going. You can't just shut down for a week because you don't feel well. And so it eventually led to my infertility. So that lack of awareness, education about my own body.
Wow, that's heavy. What did the conversations look like for you back then in the 20s?
Oh, in my 20s, yeah. I thought you meant like in the 20s, which I'm like, I'm not that old. But technically, I'm an old Gen X. I would say definitely the stigma, huge, about having a unintended pregnancy, right, without being partnered, and an expectation pretty much universally that once partnered, you would become a mother at some point. So I think I remember at some point as a general OBGYN when I started noticing the younger generation, your generation, more and more not having children and having a lot of guilt come from their older relatives about that. And I've tried to be very non-judgmental most of my life, but I remember talking to them about it's, you know, your body, your choice, and the more that you, you know, accept who you are and do what you feel is right, more of you are going to do that, it's going to suddenly become normal to not necessarily be expected as women to be mothers.
A misconception I want to talk about is that women's health equals sexual and reproductive health, and that's it. Dr. Kurtzer, what issues do you think this creates when we view women's health as only sexual health?
I think it really narrows who we are. It's taking away the complete picture of who we are as humans when it's all focused on those aspects of our life. So there are very important aspects of our life. I'm not discounting them at all, but there's more to us as far as our, you know, careers, as far as our relationships with other people, other, you know, family members, our work in the community. And so I think it really limits us. And when that happens in a medical setting, a lot of times there is a lot of extra dismissive behaviors already that are out there where women's health is already kind of marginalized. But on top of it, then you get to a certain age where you're no longer reproductively capable.
Yeah.
And nobody really cares to hear about your, you know, concerns or complaints or what's bothering you anymore. And so, again, it's kind of that you become invisible. And I think we hear a lot about that in across many fields of women feeling like they reach a certain age and they suddenly are kind of overlooked, and their resources and their expertise and all that makes them the fuller person is suddenly not, it's vanished. Yeah. It's not there anymore.
Say more on your earlier thoughts, Taisha.
It is very limiting to just focus on the reproductive part of women's health, especially when not all women want to reproduce. So especially when it comes to maybe getting bicep surgeries or just wanting other things in life and prioritizing that. If you're not worried about your sexual health, then it's almost like you are scooted to the side of, well, we have other problems to deal with, or we have other people to deal with. You're also held, I feel like, more accountable for, I speak specifically for me as being child-free, you're held to a different standard in life of, well, if you're not going to have children, then you need to make up for it in some other ways. Basically, as a woman, that was supposed to be my job. But if you're going to say that's not your job, then we have to do all these other things. And that doesn't necessarily translate to being healthy all the time.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to mental health and things like that.
Yeah. No, great points. One thing that's top of mind for me right now is the misinformation that's spreading online about birth control. So there was a recent story from the Washington Post. It was talking about a rise of online videos vilifying hormonal birth control. Things like weight gain because of birth control, others claiming that it can lead to infertility. Cheryl, have you heard people share negative experiences with hormonal birth control?
Not for me personally. I've been reading the stories and I'm just horrified.
Yeah.
Horrified, okay, by these stories and the misinformation and the beliefs and how people are just trying to once again manipulate a woman's body for political gain, for financial gain. And it just makes me so angry because women are already confused enough as a result of a vacuum, a lack of information. Every Thursday, I hold a webinar and it's mostly women, but I'm really trying to help educate them around their bodies because our bodies are so complex. It doesn't stop at, you know, when your reproductive years, it cranks up, it goes to another level.
Yeah.
After called menopause. Okay. And menopause is not only about the transition from no longer being reproductive, but it's the hormones are controlling and responsible for so many other things. And we're finding in menopause that the fluctuations impact our heart, impact our temperature, thyroid, every aspect of our bodies, that there is shocking to know that there isn't much, not enough information, not enough research has been around that, or not enough modalities, treatment for that. So when I see these videos, you know, whether influencers trying to, you know, sell a product or some political sort of overture to the video or to the article, I'm just incensed. It just seems like more of an assault against women.
Cheryl brought up menopause. So I want to turn to you, Dr. Kurtzer, because last time you were on the program was to talk about that very topic. Remind us about the knowledge gap that does exist around menopause.
the sad thing is it's huge, and it's not only women. It's the people that they're seeking help from, their doctors or other people in their lives. There's just such a lack of reliable information out there. And I think there's absolutely people taking opportunities to engage and educate, but then there's also going to be the people who are going to use that in a negative way and give, you know, misinformation and maybe ulterior motives for selling products to try to help with these symptoms, but there's not really data to support them. And you see a lot of women going down these spirals of, I have to avoid hormones, they're so dangerous, so let me try, you know, X, Y, and Z, spending lots of money, getting more and more depressed and upset because their symptoms aren't being addressed. And usually by the time they come to see somebody like me, they've already been through multiple physicians and haven't really gotten that support to say, look, there's some really reliable FDA-approved approaches to treating your symptoms, so you don't have to kind of be doing all of this searching online and through YouTube videos and influencers.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I loved when you were on the program, Doctor, and helped sort of debunk some of the myths. One of them being that you've got to be a certain age to know or care about this conversation. So I'm curious for you, Taisha, you're a junior in college.
Yes.
What sorts of questions do you have about menopause?
I actually wrote down a whole list.
Good for you, Taisha.
Yeah.
So Taisha said, I'm going to have a doctor right at my fingertips. I am going to write down my questions.
Yeah. So I know you mostly focus on perimenopause. I was asking you some of the questions in the green room. And what are some of the early signs of perimenopause? Because I was under the impression that menopause is just something that happens one day, much like your first period.
Yeah.
And I learned that that is not the case. So I'm wondering what that looks like.
And I've got this same question, too, because I had some things that happened the other day and I was like, is that that? No. Yeah. So please.
No. And it's such a great question because we do forget, right? There's this lead-in period. And I would say for many people, it's actually the hardest part of menopause transition is perimenopause. We cycle, obviously, as women. Our hormones are not stagnant and stable all the way through our monthly cycle. So we're used to those fluctuations, but we do get used to those patterns. And so when they're thrown out the window and you don't know what to expect, it can be really disconcerting. And people can actually sometimes feel like they're going crazy because they don't know what to expect during that time. And it can be really hard. But from a physical standpoint, definitely feeling more emotional, you know, depression, anxiety rates pick up. Sleep disturbances, feeling like you're really fatigued all the time. You're not getting, you maybe even if you sleep through the night, but you wake up feeling like you're not refreshed, like you didn't get restorative sleep. Menstrual changes, right? So either shortening of the cycle or lengthening of the cycle or skipping periods can start to happen during that period. More migraine headaches, more PMS symptoms. So you kind of get used to those premenstrual symptoms. We'll take them up a notch or 10 and then see how that feels and then try to go to work and get your kids to school. So it can be a really hard period of time.
And I just on that note, I wanted to add the differences going through menopause and perimenopause for Black women and other women of color. We know that for Black women, we experience a longer transition period. Say, I've been transitioning since I was 35, 34.
Really?
Rough symptoms starting at 34 to here I am now, 55. Okay. And is just intense. And that's the experience for Black women. And I think Dr. Kurtzer would know better than I, but for Asian women and Japanese women, and I can't remember the other group of women, their symptoms can be more intense. And so knowing this, but I'm just now, it took me being CEO of a telehealth company, and a predominant number of our patients are women of color, and me having a lot of interaction with the healthcare system to begin to dig and get this information. It's not out there readily. Just mentioning the word menopause freezes the room. Like, yeah. People kind of freak out, both men and women. Mm-hmm. And they just go, you know, I don't know if you attended Beyonce's concert series over the Renaissance series.
Oh, of course.
Last year. People go mute. Everybody on mute. Okay. And they they win the mute challenge on when you mention the word menopause.
Oh, my gosh.
Weird.
You know what, Cheryl? I thought I had the record for, you know, the person who working in the most Beyonce references to, but you working it into a women's health conversation, you are the queen. Taisha, we have to talk about cleansing products and hygiene. How have you noticed companies capitalizing on this?
Yes, that was actually another question that I had written down. My thing that I've noticed especially is that a lot of products will say gynecologist tested or gynecologist approved, but anytime you actually talk to a gynecologist, they usually tell you that you don't need those products.
Really?
Yes. And so I've always wondered, or I've just wondered, like, what is the difference, one, between tested and approved? And also, if there's a difference between using these products, even if they are approved, yeah, versus not at all.
Doctor?
That's a great question, and one I haven't really thought about to that degree before. But I will say, I think there's historically been cleaning products and hygiene products advertised and promoted for women, you know, even generations before ours. So if you look back in some of the history of that, you'll see even, you know, bleach and things like that being used for hygiene and some very,
bleach,
you know, very crazy bleach ads out,
wow,
there for, yeah. For,
sorry, you just shocked the entire panel.
I know. But at any rate, for gynecology, the bottom line is our vaginas are really designed just to be self-cleaning, right? So there's really no need to use any cleansing or hygiene products specifically. Some women choose to do that just because, you know, they feel like it maybe clears out some of the menstrual debris or secretions afterwards. But technically, over time, you know, the vaginal canal is going to be cleaned on its own. And that's just a function of the normal bacteria and flora that we have. Externally, you know, that's a different issue. Some of the secretions and stuff that we need to clean off from the folds and the vulvar area and hair-bearing areas, that, you know, you can use different gentle products for the skin, but they don't need to be necessarily gynecology,
yeah,
tested or confirmed or whatever.
This is good to know.
Why?
Another thing, while we're debunking myths, doctor, another one, women of older generations don't have sex and they don't need to get tested.
Oh my gosh.
What, yeah, impact do you, of think course, a misconception like that can have on older women? I can hear you rolling your eyes there, yeah, Cheryl, so I'll get to you too. But doctor, you first.
Yeah. I mean, huge, because of course, like infections, as we know from COVID, they'll choose anybody. They're opportunistic. So there's no age cutoff. And women who are of that generation, who are a little bit older, need to make sure that they are asking their partners to be tested and that they're being tested just as much as any other person who's sexually active.
Cheryl, your thoughts?
There's nothing like an empowered woman. And the older you are, the more empowered you feel. And that shows up in every area of your life, sex included. So to say, suggest that women aren't having sex, what might be in some instances, a full alignment of who they are and their sexuality and their sense of self and empowerment, they might be at their peak, okay, as we're aging. To suggest that is so like, who thinks that? That's what I want to know. Where are the people that say these crazy things?
And I do appreciate you being so open, Cheryl, with your experiences. Taisha, talk about your experience getting care when it comes to your sexual health. Because, I mean, You've got an experience that I don't think is isolated, because we know that many Black women experience inequities.
Yes.
But I'd love to hear what you've dealt with.
Yes. So I've gone through many different gynecologists, unfortunately.
Many?
Yes. So I would say probably about five. I tend to get tested very regularly. Mm-hmm. I've gone for two pap smears and then another situation that's a bit isolated. But the care I've gotten has not been consistent. I think there's one doctor who walked me through it and asked me questions and was really, really careful with me and listened to my concerns. But I've also had other doctors completely ignore the things that I was saying, ignore all of my symptoms. I've literally had a doctor tell me that it was just my anxiety one time when I was telling her some things that were going on, like with my uterus and things like that.
Yeah.
Because I do suffer from anxiety. And unfortunately, she knew that. And I think she just kind of used it against me as a way to not listen. So I did have to change my doctor from her to someone who would listen to me. Yeah. But unfortunately, that was still trial and error. And I've had to do that twice or three times.
Good for you making those changes. But it sounds like a frustrating experience.
For sure. It caused me a lot of extra anxiety.
Just the intake alone when you start at a new physician's office. Am I right, Dr. Kircher?
I was just going to say.
All like, that
it's
paperwork.
It's so hard to meet somebody
transferring
new.
The records.
Oh,
it's just a lot.
And it's, you know, it's a vulnerable, we were talking about this earlier, like you're to open up one your vulnerability about your history or what your concerns are. And then the extremely vulnerable position of a gynecologic exam, and you have to do it over and over, and you don't know if what your experience is going to be negative again like before. That's just really disheartening to hear. And I was talking about also is I just feel like it's so important for OB-GYNs, and what I hope part of my teaching is and what I do is the importance of that first exam and getting somebody off to kind of a good start with relationship with their medical team, because I've seen too many patients over the years that because that first experience or an experience was not good, then they delay care, they're not getting treatment, and then it just makes everything that much, you know, more difficult for them.
Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time, but I'd love to hear from all three of you on this final question. How do you think we can start to cultivate a relationship with our sexual health and just be comfortable with it all? Cheryl, you first.
Well, I think it's important to start with women normalizing these kinds of conversations, destigmatizing it, and to make us less anxious about our bodies. And so, you know, we're up against a lot, you know, societal norms, you know, you throw people's religions and faith in there. I mean, there are a lot of barriers for women to be comfortable enough to seek care. So we've got to be aggressive about chipping away at that challenging thinking and norms, mm-hmm. and empowering Taisha. I'm glad to hear, Taisha, that you advocated for yourself. You know, you refused to take, and you know, no for an answer. We need more of Taishas that sit comfortably in that seat of their souls and their skin and can advocate for themselves.
Yeah. Taisha, what do you think? How can we get others to really start cultivating that relationship with their sexual health?
Yeah, I think a big part of being able to advocate yourself, along with just destigmatizing it and talking about it more, is also education. I want to do sex education. That's kind of what I go to school for. It's what I study. And that is a big part of why I'm able to advocate for myself a lot, is because I know what I need to look for, and I know at least a little bit about how I should be functioning, so I can tell when things are different. And just reading as many books as you can, talking with professionals whenever you can. I like to listen to podcasts about sexual health. Honestly, just educate yourself any way that you can, because unfortunately, you just got to take those matters into your own hands.
Last word to you, Dr. Kircher.
Yeah, and I think it is unfortunate. You have to take matters into your own hands. So I'm going to call out the other people in this world of sexual health, which is our male colleagues and, you know, brothers, fathers, all the males around us, to be more supportive of women who are going through these, both their, you know, hormonal changes and transitioning into menopause, but sexual health as well. Part of the reason it's been stigmatized so much is because oftentimes women's issues are made fun of, they're minimized. So we learn to not talk about these things in front of, our families when we're growing up, when we're little, in front of our doctors who might be men, as we're, seeing our pediatricians or growing up, our gynecologists, because we've been just so acculturated to not talk about those things. And so hopefully we'll get some more male allies in this as well.
That's a great place to leave the conversation. We've been talking with Dr. Tracy Kurtzer, who's a gynecologist and menopause specialist for Northwestern Medicine Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause, Taisha Thomas, who's a student at DePaul University, and Cheryl Jackson, co-host of WBEZ's When Magic Happens. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Micah Yasin, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If there's a health topic that you'd like us to cover here on Reset, email us at reset@wbez.org or leave us a voicemail at 888-915-9945. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Let's talk again soon.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.